epidemic spreading. So this is really a huge catastrophe, and it's not a humanitarian one. It is a political catastrophe, and it's a social catastrophe.
And Professor Majid,
this would not have happened if it wasn't for the—
Go ahead. This wouldn't have happened if it weren't for—
If it wasn't for the backing and the arming of Israel.
And your response, we have just a minute, to Israel saying they're just destroying, trying to destroy Hezbollah. They're telling everyone else to leave to protect them.
Yeah, we've heard the same thing in Gaza. They're just trying to destroy Hamas. I mean, two things. First, it's important to understand who Hezbollah is. Hezbollah, of course, is a political and military organization, but Hezbollah is also has a social base, and these are not people that are involved in military action.
Rima, we have just
15
seconds.
The other thing that I want to highlight is that the war of Israel on Lebanon has not started with the creation of Hezbollah in 82. Israel has invaded Lebanon way before 82. Hezbollah was created as a result of the Beirut invasion in 82. So the aim, I think, is not just Hezbollah, but the aim is to kill any possible resistance to a state
Rima
that
Majid,
is,
we're
that
gonna
has
leave
no
it
borders
there
and
from the American University of Beirut, but we're gonna do part two and post it online at democracynow.org. Stay with us, please. I'm Amy Goodman.
Thanks for listening to KVOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at kvoo.fm.
KVOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KVOO. In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kvoo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Meetings are held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kvoo.fm. Please visit our website to verify that a meeting is being held.
This morning, we will not be broadcasting more talk radio with Cecil Prescott. He will be back next week. Please enjoy the next show on the schedule. And thank you for listening to KBOO, Portland.
Hello, you're listening to Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. Today we're going to be listening to a presentation by the Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History and Professor of Middle East History Emeritus of Stanford University, Joel Benin, on Understanding October 7th, 2023, and Israel's War on the Gaza Strip. This event is sponsored by the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon. If you would like to contact the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon, please write to jpaopdx@proton.me. And now for today's presentation. Thank you.
Well, welcome everybody to this first presentation hosted by the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon. My name is Will Singer. And we are very, very fortunate to have with us the Professor of Middle East History and Professor of History Emeritus at Stanford University, Joel Benin. And he's going to be talking with us. The title for his presentation today is Understanding October 7, 2023 and Israel's War on the Gaza Strip. So Joel, take it away. Thank you.
Thank you, Will, and thank you, everyone, for coming. So as we all know, on October 7th, 2023, Hamas and its allies launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood against Israel. Some 2,000 to 3,000 Hamas fighters and others invaded Israel and attacked and in some cases occupied 20 rural sites, 3 towns, 7 army bases. A total of 1,139 people were killed that day, 695 Israeli civilians, among them 38 children, 373 army and police officers, and 71 foreigners, primarily Thai agricultural workers who were employed in the kibbutzim along the border of the Gaza Strip. About 8,700 people were wounded and 250 were taken hostage. People were tortured physically and sexually abused. There's been a great deal of debate about the sexual abuse question. And if people want to ask a question about it, please do. I think at this point, what we can say is that there was sexual abuse and we don't know exactly how much and under what circumstances and the extent to which it was or was not premeditated. This was, from the Israeli point of view, a massive security and intelligence and first response failure. It is first and foremost due to the fact that in the days just before October 7th, the priority of the government of Israel led by Benjamin Netanyahu was to defend the settlement project. Since May of 2021, the Unity Intifada that erupted that month, there has been escalating armed resistance of Palestinians and, in response, escalating settler violence against Palestinians and also violence by the Israeli army directed against Palestinians. So in 2021, 2022, and the first part of 2023, in each of those years, there was an escalating new record for Palestinian deaths in the West Bank. There were, from January to June 2023, 570 settler attacks on Palestinians, 50 Palestinian attacks on Israelis, 140 or more Palestinians and 30 or more Israelis were killed in the West Bank before October 7th. So there was a high level of violent tension in the area well before October 7th. However, you may recall that in February of 2023, there was a settler pogrom directed against the northern West Bank village of Hawara. One Palestinian was killed, lots of property was damaged, people were wounded and attacked, and the Israeli army stood by while this was happening. The settlers, not being satisfied with that, decided to build a sukkah, a hut, which is used in the celebration of the annual Jewish holiday of Sukkot, to mark the Israelites wandering in the desert after they escaped from slavery in Egypt. So the settlers built a sukkah right in the middle of the main street of Hawara. And since Hawara had been attacked by settlers earlier in the year, there was good reason to think this sukkah might be attacked. And so the army decided that they should send military units from Gaza to the West Bank, to Hawara, to defend the Sukkah, and so an entire military unit, which would have normally been on the border of the Gaza Strip, was not, because they were defending the settlers in the northern West Bank. But that is only one little piece of a much, much more massive security and intelligence failure. Another aspect of the failure is the broad neglect of the Western Negev, or Naqab, and in particular, the Gaza envelope, or Otef Aza in Hebrew, which is the inhabited area surrounding the Gaza Strip. And one of the reasons for this is that the kibbutzim, there are some moshavim there as well, and then they would fall under this category as well, of the region of Otef Aza are leftists. What does that mean? It means they don't vote for the Likud or any of the parties of the current Israeli government. They vote for Meretz, or they vote for the Labor Party. And therefore, from the point of view of the current government of Israel, they are political enemies. And indeed, some of the people who were killed by Hamas and its allies on October 7th were very prominent peace activists. Vivian Silver, for example, of Kibbutz Be'eri, was very well known even internationally. Chaim Katzman of Kibbutz Cholit, who was also killed, had been active while he was a PhD student at the University of Washington, and then continued his peace activism after he returned to Israel after he received his PhD. This failure of the Israeli government to attend to the needs of the people and the Israeli settlements in the area was widely noted. Amir Tibon, who is a columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, but happens to live on Kibbutz Nachal Oz, which was one of the kibbutzim that was attacked, wrote in Haaretz the next day, "The Israeli state failed us." Anderson Cooper did a special on Kibbutz near Oz, which was one of the kibbutzim that was most heavily attacked. A quarter of the people of near Oz were either killed or taken hostage on October 7th. And one of the kibbutz members told Anderson Cooper, "We were abandoned by the state." The neglect of the Western Negev, or the Gaza envelope, is a broader part of a broader neglect of the periphery in Israel by the Netanyahu government since Netanyahu became prime minister in 2009. In Israel, Tel Aviv and its northern suburbs in particular are the center, and settlements that are in the south or in the north are called the periphery. And as happens in any neoliberal system of governance, the gap between the haves and the have-nots is increased. And so Tel Aviv became relatively richer, and the periphery became relatively poor, which was mediated to some extent by the fact that kibbutzim take some care about equalizing income. But in broad sense, there was neglect of the infrastructure, of investment, of education, of healthcare, of first responder capacity in the periphery. And Chagai Matar, who is the executive editor of 972, which is an excellent source of information about Israel-Palestine, a webzine jointly edited by Palestinian and Jewish Israelis, Chagai Matar wrote The collapse of our sense of security came hand in hand with the realization that the entire Israeli state is in fact nothing more than a hologram. The army rescue services, the welfare services, and more have all been dysfunctional. Years of political corruption have left us with an empty shell of a state and with no leadership to speak of. So since October 7th, this sentiment, which was expressed only a month after, this sentiment has become much broader, and many people now speak about the impending collapse of the state of Israel. I think that's a little bit overblown, but certainly we can speak of many aspects of Israel as things that happen in places we call failed states. Now, there was actually a rationale for what Israel did and didn't do regarding the Gaza Strip in particular. So again, Benjamin Netanyahu has been continuously prime minister of Israel since 2009 at the head of several governments, with the exception of the brief period of June 2021 to December 2022. And during that time, several people noted that it was his strategy to support and strengthen Hamas, particularly vis-a-vis the Palestinian Authority, which is led by Hamas's political rival, the Fatah movement. So those who want to support the possibility of a Palestinian state should support the strengthening of Hamas and the transfer of money to Hamas. That was something that Netanyahu said to a meeting of Likud leaders, and is quoted in the Hebrew book by Chaim Ramon, who is a knowledgeable figure about such matters. Major General Gershon HaKohen, who is a Netanyahu confidant, said, "We need to tell the truth. Netanyahu's strategy is to prevent the option of two states, so he is turning Hamas into his closest partner. Openly, Hamas is an enemy. Covertly, it's an ally." And then Adam Raz, who wrote in Haaretz shortly after the October 7th attack, "For 14 years, Netanyahu's policy was to keep Hamas in power. The pogrom of October 7th, 2023 helps the Israeli prime minister preserve his own rule." So that was the logic of building up Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And Netanyahu and his political allies believed that Hamas was more or less contained by this strategy. Hamas supposedly became more interested in matters of governance rather than in continuing armed resistance to the Israeli occupation. And this would tend to, in the long run, moderate Hamas. That was the theory. And because that theory literally blew up on October 7th, and Israelis were totally shocked and humiliated by the Hamas attack that day, the response was extreme, to the point of ridiculous in terms of characterizing what happened. So Netanyahu said Hamas is ISIS, and former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said, "We're fighting Nazis." Foreign Minister Eli Cohen, who is actually one of the less diplomatic members of the current Israeli government, even though as foreign minister, you'd expect him to be the chief diplomat, said that the massacre is more brutal than ISIS. Hamas are the new Nazis. And President Biden said Hamas have engaged in barbarism as consequential as the Holocaust. This is all utter and total nonsense, has no basis in reality whatsoever. It's not to say that the Hamas attack wasn't serious and brutal, but no, we're not talking about Nazi activity or something that rivals the Holocaust in its scope or character. What is Hamas then, if they aren't ISIS or new Nazis or any such thing like that? Hamas is an expression of jihadist Palestinian nationalism, and we can see that quite clearly in their 1988 covenant. Hamas began its life as the Palestinian branch of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, and you can see that influence in the opening sections of the covenant. Because the first paragraph quoted there, Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam will obliterate it. That quote is from Hassan al-Banna, who was the founder of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, the organization established in 1928, and which subsequently became the largest Sunni Muslim Islamist organization. Another expression of Hamas's origins in the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is the passage in the covenant that says Allah is its goal, the Prophet is its model, the Quran is its constitution, jihad is its path, and death for the sake of Allah is the loftiest of its visions, that's of its wishes. That is exactly a quote from the literature and propaganda of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. When it gets to the question of Palestine, again, the covenant is very clear. There is no solution for the Palestinian question except through jihad. The 1988 covenant also imports classic European anti-Semitic tropes. So it talks about lackeys who are infiltrated through Zionist organizations under various names and shapes, such as the Freemasons and the Rotary Club. Once I was giving a talk to the Rotary Club in Menlo Park, and somebody asked me, what's up with Hamas? Why don't they like the Rotary Club? And I was not speaking about Hamas, and I hadn't at that point read Hamas's charter. And I said, I don't know, but no, there they are. The Rotary Club are infiltrated by Zionists. That's their problem. The covenant also says that Hamas considers itself to be the spearhead of the circle of struggle with world Zionism and a step on the road. Islamic groupings all over the Arab world should also do the same, since all of these are the best equipped for the future role in the fight with the warmongering Jews. So again, openly anti-European, anti-Semitic tropes in the 1988 Hamas covenant. That terminology was subsequently removed from Hamas's political vocabulary. We'll get to that in a little bit later on. So because in part of the embarrassment, shock, humiliation that Israel felt and the trauma from the attack of October 7th, the Israeli rhetorical response was very, very over the top. So Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in a number of political statements, quoted from the book of Deuteronomy and the book of Samuel, where the Israelites are commanded, remember what Amalek has done to you. Amalek attacked the Israelites as they were wandering in the desert for no good reason, as the text of the Hebrew Bible has it. And therefore, the Israelites are commanded to kill every single man, woman, and children of the Amalekites, and also all of their animals, their donkeys and their goats and their sheep and their camels. And King Saul, the first Israelite king, did in fact make war on the Amalekites, but he spared the Amalekite king. And for that reason, he was not allowed to be the founder of the kingly dynasty that ruled the Israelites. That honor was given to King David instead. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant announced early on, I've ordered a complete siege on the Gaza Strip. There will be no electricity, no food, no fuel. Everything is closed. This is the ISIS of Gaza. We are fighting human animals and we are acting accordingly. So whether or not we want to make the legal conclusion that Israel has committed genocide in the Gaza Strip since October 7th. This and Benjamin Netanyahu's statement about Amalek is a statement of with clear genocidal intent. There can't be any doubt about the matter of intent, which is often quite difficult to prove in matters of genocide and which is essential to making the legal determination. The security cabinet member and agriculture minister, Avi Dichter, who is actually far more important in the hierarchy of the Likud than that position would indicate, spoke about rolling out the Gaza Nakba. And again, Major General Giora Eiland, who is close to Netanyahu, wrote in major Israeli daily, the state of Israel has no choice but to turn Gaza into a place that is temporarily or permanently impossible to live in. So again, clear genocidal intent. I gleaned all of these from the Israeli press, and then Mark Landler did me the favor of collecting in the New York Times 18,000 genocidal statements by Israelis that were posted on X, including 286 statements by prominent Israelis with political or military authority inciting potentially unlawful behavior. So the question of genocidal intent, I think, is pretty much open and shut. And in retaliating against the Hamas attack on October 7th, Israel has to date killed at least 42,000 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, about two-thirds of whom are women and children. There are at least 10,000, probably a good many more, missing and presumed dead under the rubble. The actual number of dead is very likely considerably higher than that, especially if we add to it people who have or will have died from infectious diseases that were otherwise preventable, from starvation and lack of medical care and so on. At this point, I think the number of wounded is over 100,000, but these numbers are malleable in that way. And about 2 million people, residents of the Gaza Strip, have been forcibly displaced since October 7th. Israel's bombing attacks in particular have had massive negative impact on the infrastructure. 60% of residential buildings damaged, 80% of commercial facilities damaged, 65% of the cropland has been damaged, 17 out of 36 hospitals are only partly functional, 65% of the road network has been damaged, 85% of school buildings, and of course there are other important institutions like mosques and churches and universities and cultural institutions that have also been destroyed. Now, this attack and Israel's response have a long history. The history of Israel and Palestine did not begin on October 7th, 2023. And one plausible place to begin it is the Palestinian Nakba of 1948, when 750,000 Palestinians were either directly expelled or frightened into fleeing from their homes by Israeli forces. And as a result, some 75 to 80% of the population of the Gaza Strip were on October 7th either actual refugees from 1948 or descendants of those refugees. And because the population of the Gaza Strip, which didn't exist as such before 1948, was so heavily comprised of refugees, it was early on a center of Palestinian resistance to Israel. lots of refugees try to return to their lands, to harvest their crops, to retrieve property that they returned, that they had hidden, to visit their family and so on. This was termed infiltration by Israel. And some 280 to 340 Israeli civilians were killed by Palestinians returning between 1949 and 1956. 250 soldiers were killed in retaliation raids that Israel carried out. 2,700 to 5,000 Palestinians were killed during these retaliation raids, and 30 to 40,000 Palestinians who were living in Israel legally after 1948 were expelled either to the Gaza Strip, to Lebanon, or to Jordan. Israel established a special forces unit, Unit 101, to carry out large-scale retaliation raids against Palestinian infiltrators, as they were called. The two main figures in that unit were Ariel Sharon, who subsequently had an important political and military career, and Meir Hartzion, who is less known, but kind of a Wild Bill Cody type figure. The first action of this unit, which was supposed to be a training mission, was an attack on the El Burej refugee camp in the Gaza Strip in August of 1953. The unit led by Sharon was discovered, and as he reported, "I decided that offensive action was better than giving the impression that we were attempting to escape. Therefore, I invaded the camp with my group." So the exercise, the training exercise, was to surveil the camp and go back to the borders, inside the borders of Israel. But when the group was discovered, Sharon ordered them to attack, and they killed 30 Palestinian refugees and wounded 22. Another major exploit of Unit 101 was an important raid on Gaza City, in which an Egyptian army base was attacked, and 37 Egyptians were killed, and 8 Israelis also lost their lives in that raid. In this back and forth across the border with the Gaza Strip, a very well-known event in Israeli history is the murder and of Roi Rothberg, who was the security coordinator for Kibbutz Nachal Oz, which was also attacked on October 7th, 2023. He was killed on October 28th, 1956. Moshe Dayan, who was then chief of staff of the Israeli army, happened to be in the area and had met Rothberg and was impressed by him the previous day. And so he gave the eulogy, and I'm going to quote at some length Dayan's speech, because this is, in many respects, the Gettysburg Address of Israel. It's very famous, very much captures the ethos of pre-1967 Israel, which was not explicitly adapted, but became very much the kind of ethos of the post-1967 settlement project as well. So Dayan wrote, "Yesterday with daybreak, Roi was murdered. The quiet of a spring morning blinded him, and he did not see the stalkers of his soul on the furrow. Let us not hurl blame at the murderer. Why should we complain of their hatred for us? 8 years have they sat in the refugee camps of Gaza and seen with their own eyes how we have made a homeland of the soil and the villages where they and their forebears once dwelt. Not from the Arabs of Gaza must we demand the blood of Roi, but from ourselves. How our eyes are closed to the reality of our fate, unwilling to see the destiny of our generation in its full cruelty. Have we forgotten that this small band of youths settled in Nachal Oz carries on its shoulders the heavy gates of Gaza, beyond which hundreds of thousands of eyes and arms huddle together and pray for the onset of our weakness so that they may tear us to pieces. Has this been forgotten? For we know that if the hope of our destruction is to perish, we must be morning and evening armed and ready. A generation of settlement are we, and without the steel helmet and the maw of the cannon, we shall not plant a tree nor build a house. Our children shall not have lives to live if we do not dig shelters, and without the barbed wire fence and machine guns, we shall not pave a path nor drill for water. The millions of Jews annihilated without a land peer out at us from the ashes of Israeli history and command us to settle and rebuild the land for our people. But beyond the furrow that marks the border lies a surging sea of hatred and vengeance, yearning for the day that the tranquility blunts our alertness, for the day that we heed the ambassadors of conspiring hypocrisy who call for us to lay down our arms. So there's lots in that speech, lots of biblical references, and as a piece of Hebrew writing, it's quite extraordinary. We won't do that analysis for our purpose. The important thing is that Moshe Dayan is 100% clear about the settler colonial character of Kibbutz Nachal Oz, and of course also the neighboring kibbutzim, and is warning the Israeli people of what they need to do because of that. And he succeeded. I think we can say that he succeeded. So we won't go through the whole history of the Gaza Strip from that period, but we'll go back now a few years to see what else is relevant to understanding what happened on October 7th. And for that purpose, we'll begin with the unilateral Israeli engagement from the Gaza Strip and also simultaneously four settlements in the northern West Bank, but we won't talk about those, in August, September of 2005. Ariel Sharon was Prime Minister of Israel, the very same Ariel Sharon who we saw on the previous slide as leading the force that attacked the Buraid refugee camp in 1953. This was his plan, and his principal advisor, Dov Weissglass, explained it to the public in these terms. The significance of the disengagement plan is the freezing of the peace process. When you freeze that process, you prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state, and you prevent a discussion on the refugees, the borders, and Jerusalem. Disengagement supplies the amount of formaldehyde that is necessary so that there will not be a political process with the Palestinians. So that perspective was not only the perspective of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after he came to power in 2009, it was also the perspective of his predecessor, Ariel Sharon. And indeed, it is a core element of the political platform of the Likud party, to which they both belonged, although Sharon actually left the Likud over this. That's an internal Israeli politics that we won't talk about unless people ask. So the Israeli government proceeded to evacuate about 9,000 settlers from the southern Gaza Strip and also from the Rafah area, the border with Egypt. And there was enormous resistance on the part of the settlers. They made this into a very dramatic event the point of that was to make it very difficult for any subsequent Israeli government to imagine evacuating settlements. And in fact, it's been a very rare instance that settlements have been evacuated. No legally established settlements have been evacuated. These were legally established. Illegally established settlements that the Israeli government then turned a blind eye to, in some cases, were evacuated. Next stage on the road to October 7th was the Palestinian Legislative Council election of 2006. The Palestinian Legislative Council was established during the Oslo process that began with the signing of the Oslo Declaration the Oslo Accords, Declaration of Principles in 2003. Hamas initially boycotted the electoral process. They didn't participate in the first Legislative Council election of 1996. They boycotted the January 2005 presidential election, which was won by Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah. Mahmoud Abbas is still president of the Palestinian Authority. His term should have expired in 2010. The fact that this is utterly undemocratic and procedurally irregular has not bothered Israel or the United States too much. Hamas did enter and win the second Palestinian Legislative Council election, which was finally of its final stages held on January 25th, 2006. In the graphic, you can see the distribution of the seats. Hamas, even though it won a strong majority of the seats, actually only won a plurality of the popular vote, about 48%. We're quite familiar with that kind of thing in the United States, where presidents have been elected without winning a majority of the popular vote several times in recent electoral cycles. What's interesting to note is that Hamas ran on with an electoral list called Change and Development, did not run on a program of jihad, of armed resistance against the Israeli occupation, although, of course, Hamas was and is well known for that, but rather it ran against the corruption of Fatah and the inability of Fatah to bring the Oslo Accords to fruition in the form of a Palestinian state, and of the economic stagnation that occurred both in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip in the wake of the failure of the Oslo process and the outbreak of the Second Intifada in the year 2000. Meanwhile, Hamas, in the later stages of the Second Intifada, was beginning to flirt with the idea of, in practice, if not in principle, abandoning armed struggle against Israel and not recognizing the state of Israel, but accommodating to the state of Israel. So Khaled Mash'al in February of 2006 suggested that, and he was then the head of the political bureau of Hamas, suggested that Hamas would stop armed struggle if Israel recognized the 1967 borders, that is the borders of the state of Israel before the June 1967 Arab-Israeli War, withdrew from all of the Palestinian occupied territories, and recognized Palestinian rights, including the right to return. Those terms, while they are a radical departure from Hamas's classical positions, are, of course, not exactly terms that any Israeli government would be prepared to accept as the basis of an agreement. But the Israeli government didn't want to test either whether something more was on offer. Henry Seigman, who was often in contact with Hamas leaders during this period, an Orthodox rabbi, a survivor of the Holocaust, former director of the American Jewish Committee, so a fairly prominent figure in the American Jewish hierarchy, wrote in the New York Review of Books. A prominent senior member of Hamas's political committee said Hamas is prepared to explicitly recognize the state of Israel. So that's one senior member, and it's not clear which one, not a decision by Hamas. But what you have here are clearly indications that there's some wiggle room. If Israel was interested in reaching a negotiated settlement with Hamas, but it was not, And in fact, after Hamas won the Palestinian Legislative Council election and then proceeded to establish a government, first it offered a national unity government with Fatah, but Fatah, under pressure from the United States and other international forces, declined to enter a national unity government, and instead, encouraged by the United States and Israel, Fatah attempted to execute a coup d'etat against Hamas rule. Hamas discovered the plot and militarily suppressed it before it could come to fruition. You can read all about that in a remarkable article in Vanity Fair, of all places. There has not been a lot of other reporting of this event, and therefore in the American media, it's usually said Hamas seized control of Gaza, with no mention of what the circumstances are. In any case, in the wake of the Hamas attempted coup, Hamas did seize control of Gaza, and Fatah and the Palestinian Authority retained control of the West Bank. Israeli policy then, after Hamas was ensconced in power in the Gaza Strip in 2007, was to collaborate with Egypt. Egyptian collaboration is important because the southern border of the Gaza Strip is a border with Egypt, not with Israel. Israel began restricting imports, exports, water supply, electricity supply. Israel continued to control, it controlled before and continues to control, the entry and exit from the Gaza Strip, the airspace, the coastline, and even the population register. So if someone is born in the Gaza Strip and they aren't registered in the population register, they may have no possibility whatsoever to leave the territory at all, because they won't have any kind of legal documentation for their existence. Because of these measures, and I won't go through this in any detail, the international consensus is that Israel remained the occupying power in the Gaza Strip, despite the fact that its military was withdrawn and its settlements were withdrawn from the Gaza Strip in 2005, and further that the Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip amounted to collective punishment, which was a violation of Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. This particular quote is from the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Situation in the Palestinian Territory Occupied Since 1967, but many other knowledgeable legal observers have confirmed those conclusions. So the Gaza Strip looked like this, with Israel imposing a fishing limit of 6 nautical miles in the north, 15 nautical miles in the south, but that was the formal limit. In fact, it often restricted fishing even further, meaning that one of the important sources of protein for the inhabitants of the Gaza Strip, fish, was limited. Israel constructed a wall and fence around the Gaza Strip and declared that there was a no-go area for several hundred meters in back of that fence, and in back of that no-go area, a high-risk area. So many Palestinians were killed and wounded by Israeli fire simply for entering into these areas. Some of the massive consequences of Israeli policy in imposing this siege on the Gaza Strip. Population grew, but population density grew. Households that were food insecure or food vulnerable increased. GDP per capita decreased. The unemployment rate increased. And as a result of all of these circumstances and more, the UN Conference on Trade and Development declared in 2017 that Gaza would become uninhabitable as of 2020. So by October 7th, 2023, according to projections by knowledgeable UN authorities, Gaza had actually been uninhabitable for some 3 years. Now, I mentioned that Hamas did evolve politically from its 1988 covenant, and that was expressed in a document of general principles and policies that it published in 2017. And that document says, Hamas considers the establishment of a fully sovereign and independent Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital along the lines of the 4th of June 1967, that is to say before the June 1967 Arab-Israeli War, with the return of the refugees and the displaced to their homes from which they were expelled, to be a formula of national consensus. What does that actually mean? It means that if Fatah were to negotiate a Palestinian state roughly along these lines, which would certainly not include return of the refugees, but could in principle, if you had a willing Israeli government, which there has never been, include something like recognition of the right of the refugees to return without necessarily all of them actually returning, since many of them wouldn't in fact return, that Hamas would accept that as national consensus if it were submitted to a Palestinian referendum in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and if it were to receive a majority. They are not envisioning, as Fatah does not envision, that diaspora Palestinians will get to vote on something like this. This document also redefines the conflict as a conflict with the Zionist project and not with Jews because of their religion, and the anti-Semitic language of the 1988 charter was eliminated, and all the references to the Muslim Brotherhood were eliminated, and this document no longer talks about Palestine as a Muslim waqf or an unalienable endowment, which would prevent the kind of agreement that is highlighted here in the green. So Hamas by 2017 had demonstrated much greater political flexibility, nothing that would entice a Likud government to alter its policy. And both the Likud government and the United States backing it refused not only Hamas's political reorientation, but also popular nonviolent struggle that took place in the Gaza Strip as well as other places, but here we're focusing on the Gaza Strip. So Ahmed Abu Artima, a young independent journalist, wrote on Facebook on January 29th, 2018, in response to former President Trump's recognition of Israel's annexation of East Jerusalem. All these successive humanitarian disasters in the Gaza Strip must expedite the implementation of the peaceful sit-in for refugees near the dividing line with the occupation. So what was dubbed the Great March of Return, and which was initiated on Land Day, March 30th, 2018, that's a National Palestinian Day of Commemoration, which commemorates six Palestinian citizens of Israel who were killed during a protest against the Israeli expropriation of Palestinian lands in the Galilee. So the Great March of Return, which was inaugurated on March 30th, 2018, involved mostly peaceful demonstrations of Palestinians, primarily refugees, on the dividing line between the Gaza Strip and Israel proper. And these demonstrations continued every week from March 30th, 2018 until December 27th, 2019. And what was Israel's response to these demonstrations? It was to line up sharpshooters on the hillocks across from the boundary with the Gaza Strip and to shoot Palestinians in very great numbers. That mainly what was done was to shoot at people's lower limbs. So 214 Palestinians were killed during this period, but over 36,000, including 8,800 children, were wounded. There are many disabled Palestinians, permanently disabled Palestinians, as a result of those Israeli attacks on the demonstrators. Again, for the most part, these demonstrations were unarmed and peaceful. There were, at certain points, Hamas seized control of the this activity. It was originally not sponsored by Hamas or any other political parties. It was independent. Hamas seized control by virtue of the fact that they are the ones who have the capacity to set up the tent encampments, to provide food, to provide medical services, and so on. So eventually, things like sending explosive or inflammatory balloons across the border into Israel, which did in fact succeed in burning fields and creating lots of other minor damage on the Israeli side of the border, did happen. The biggest single day of confrontation during the Great March of Return was May 14th, 2018, which was the day that the new U.S. embassy in East Jerusalem was inaugurated. Israel killed 57 Palestinians in one day because the demonstrations were particularly large and militant on that day. I'm going to end with one of the things that happened during the Great March of Return was the murder of Ruzan Najjar, a young Palestinian medic from Gaza. She was unarmed. She was not a member of Hamas. She had participated in the demonstrations as a medic, and she was killed by an Israeli sniper. After she was killed, the Israeli military released a video, which was a doctored version of an interview that she did with the pro-Hamas Lebanese TV station, which purported to show that she was participating in the protest as a human shield at the request of Hamas. Subsequent investigation revealed that the interview had been doctored to distort her words. The original video didn't mention Hamas. She called herself a rescuing human shield to protect and save the wounded at the front lines. The IDF was subsequently criticized for tampering with the video in order to tarnish her image, but nothing much happened. Half a year later, the New York Times published an investigation into the whole affair, and the Times wrote, "The bullet that killed her, the Times found, was fired by an Israeli sniper into a crowd that included white-coated medics in plain view. A detailed reconstruction stitched together from hundreds of crowdsourced videos and photographs showed that neither the medics nor anyone around them posed any apparent threat of violence to Israeli personnel. Though Israel later admitted her killing was unintentional, the shooting appears to have been reckless at best and possibly a war crime for which no one has yet been punished." That was true in 2018, and it is true in 2024 that no one has been punished for this potential war crime. Now, why do I choose to end with this? Because here is a clear instance in which Israeli propaganda distorted physical evidence to support a bald-faced lie about who did what to Ruzan Najjar on June 1st, 2018. In fact, her death was not unintentional. She was shot by a sniper who fired precisely, and she was doing nothing whatsoever, nor was anyone in her immediate vicinity doing anything whatsoever that threatened any Israeli. And so the Israeli effort to lie about this and to whitewash their behavior, we have seen repeated several times in the course of the next several years. For example, the Israeli murder of the Palestinian American journalist Shireen Abu Akla in Jenin, and much of what happened in the Gaza Strip after October 7th during Israel's massive retaliation, which I think we can certainly say is genocidal in intent. I'll end there. And thank you for listening. And if you have any questions, I'll be very happy.
Thank you, Joel. And thank you, everybody, for taking part in this, as I say, first presentation sponsored by the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon. Thank you, Joel, for, again, an excellent and wonderful and comprehensive discussion of where we are today. Obviously, a lot more to be said on this topic, and we hope that we will be doing more of these kinds of presentations and discussions in the not-too-distant future.
You just heard a lecture by the Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History and Professor of Middle East History Emeritus of Stanford University, Joel Benin, on Understanding October 7th, 2023, and Israel's War on the Gaza Strip. This was sponsored by the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon. If you'd like more information about the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon, you're welcome to write them at japaopdx@proton.me. And thanks again for listening to Radio Zion here on KBOO Community Radio. يلي خدتو محبوبي محبوبي تحت الله شو خليتو خليتو يلي خدتو محبوبي محبوبي تحت الله شو خليتو خليتو سبع مكاويب النار بالنار سبع مكاويب النار بالنار جوا قلبي حطيته علالة جوا قلبي حطيته علالة لا لا يا عمي لا لا علالة
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence.